3 years ago, a dream was born. A dream of me sitting in a really warm room in front of a microphone. Of the sound guy, Nick, swearing at me through the glass. And of you Earthlets listening at home, in the car, exercising, and probably swearing at me too. In this episode of the 2080 Throwcast, we celebrate 3 years of the galaxy's greatest podcast. Borag Thung, Earthlets, and welcome to the third anniversary edition of the 2080 Thrillcast. Thank you to everyone who stuck with us over the past 3 years. Welcome to newcomers and to people who are catching up. I hope you've enjoyed all the episodes that we've done. Many more to come over 2018, and we've got a special one. This week we have a themed episode around Star Wars: The Last Jedi, which I hope you've seen. If you haven't, I recommend you do, because it's a bit spoilery, this episode. But it was fantastic to talk to Jock and to Chris Weston, both names that should be very familiar to 2080 fans, about their work creating costumes for the latest Star Wars movie. I very much enjoyed sitting down and chatting with them about the influences on their art, some of the things they got to do, and how cool is it that they were working on Star Wars? So I hope you will enjoy that as much as I did. But it wouldn't be a birthday party unless there was at least one present. So we are giving a very lucky Earthlet the chance to win a year's subscription to 2000 AD. Yes, you heard that right. We are going to give you 12 months free 2000 AD. Wait until the end of the episode to find out how you can win that. But we had a fantastic sit down with Jock and Chris to talk about their work on The Last Jedi. You will have seen some of their costume designs if you've seen the film, from the cloak that Carrie Fisher didn't just wear in the film, but also wore for that fantastic Vanity Fair photo shoot not long before she sadly passed away, through to the costume for Rose, for the caretakers on the island where Luke is hiding. It's just wonderful to hear just how much they influenced the look of one of my favourite films, and I will absolutely countenance no talking back on that. So sit down, relax, and enjoy our third birthday episode, Earthlets. And don't forget to stay tuned to find out how you can win a year's supply of 2000 AD. Let's start off with you, Chris. Can you tell us a bit about how you came to be working on the Last Jedi? Because you've done quite a bit of film work over the last 10 years or so, haven't you?
Yeah. Mostly on films that don't get made. I think I've worked on about, I think last time I counted, I think there were 6 films I worked on that didn't get made.
Wow.
How did I get on it? I think it's all down to a storyboard a friend of mine called David Alcock, and he was in the storyboard department, and I think they needed to take on more storyboard artists. And being a kind person, he piped up and said, "Oh, you want to get Chris Weston? I'll show you some of his stuff." And so he dragged up some of my stuff on the internet, and I think it was Rick Heinrichs looked at it and said, "Yeah, I like it, but he's not a storyboard artist. He's a costume designer." Okay. So I think there was a vacancy at the costume department going as well. So he then phoned Dave Crossman and said, "I think we found someone for your department. If there's still a space going." And then I just got a call from David Crossman, and I think the next morning I just jumped in my car and came up to Pinewood and had a look around.
Oh, right, okay. Because, I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, you have been a storyboard, because you storyboarded the Book of Eli, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, most of my other... I'm a weird sort of middle ground person. I don't think there's an actual job title for stuff I've done on films, because they're sort of... I kind of do hyper-detailed storyboards. You know, they verge very closely on being concept art, and So I suppose when Rick Heinrichs looked at it, he thought, you know, oh, you know, these are more finished than the storyboards they needed. But we like him, so we'll find a job for him somewhere else.
I mean, that suggests there's a quite a different attitude on something like The Last Jedi towards storyboarding as opposed to something like The Book of Eli. Because I remember chatting to you years ago about Book of Eli and how you said that it's the Hughes brothers, isn't it, who did that?
Yes, that's right.
How they looked at the stuff you were doing and kind of went, well, this, you know, this looks exactly what we want, so we'll actually base the shots on this. And there were one or two shots of that film that were line by line what you'd done.
Yeah,
in the
really, really close.
But that suggests that the storyboards for something like The Last Jedi were a bit more loose and, I don't know, gave greater scope to the director and the cinematographer and things like that?
I wouldn't know, really, because I didn't see them. They were in a completely different department to us. They were in the big modern studio, in the big modern building with that was, you know, possibly a little bit warmer than our room.
So was this literally like a room in which you all sat?
We were. I'll let Jock take over on this one because I've done all the talking so far.
The cost. Well, I mean, on a film as big as Last Jedi, yeah, there's obviously hundreds of people working on it, and they're all divided into various departments, and our area was an amazing sort of old, almost like an industrial kind of hangar. But what was good about it, because even though the guys in the art department were in the new building, they just had their computers, but we literally had, like, you know, materials, you know, next to us on rails were all the costumes from Force Awakens and everything. So it was a really cool place to work. But yeah, it was just basically one big room with a costume designer, you know, supervisors and various people in there. And that was our department.
Mm. I remember there was an amusing moment where Tonchi was given the task of updating Finn's jacket. And he was sitting there going, oh, I've got to find some reference to Finn's jacket so I can redraw it and, you know, add bits where it's been patched up from the wounds he received in Force Awakens. And he goes, oh, and he's like tapping, and he goes, I can't find any decent pictures of the jacket anyway. And then I think Jock said, it's right behind you. It was hanging up on a hanger right behind him. And he was like, oh, right, okay, we've got the actual thing.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Tonchi there. How closely did the bunch of you sort of work together, or did each of you have your own tasks and you just kind of got on with them?
It was like the monkeys, you know, or the Beatles in Help. You know? We were like there was Tonchi, Rob Rowley, Jock, and I, and we just formed a little unit, really. Yeah, we sort of hung out together, went for a curry once a week, pretty much went to lunch together. So we're just sort of like a little unit, really.
Yeah, we'd all, I mean, to answer specifically what you're asking there, Mike, it actually varied. There'd be some jobs where Michael Kaplan, the costume designer, would get us all in the design room, and, you know, there was obviously certain jobs and certain tasks that were coming up with the various characters and what they had to look like and new characters and what have you, and they'd occasionally call us all in and tell us about this, you know, this new task, and we'd all have a go at it, but then there'd also be, you know, we'd all have specific things to do. Like Chris was amazing at the creatures, for example. There wasn't that much of them in the end, but there were those, the caretakers that were on the island at the beginning that looked after Luke. Chris just, like, I mean, how many drawings of those guys did you do, Chris? You just completely went off, and they're incredible.
Oh, thank you very much. Probably about 30 in total by the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I was quite lucky that I ended up doing quite a few of the principals. Tonchi, like for example, the Praetorian Guards, you know, the Red Guards, Red Guys, which look, you know, stunning. That was definitely one of those jobs that was going to be coming up on the horizon. And they had mood boards and all kinds of, you know, influences and inspirations for us all to sort of think about. And Tonchi literally just did one pass at them. And I mean, Chris, they're pretty close. You know, that first pass was pretty close to what they ended up as. And we all just looked at them and we were just like, well, Tonchi, you know, you've done it. Like, we don't even need to take a pass at this because they just look so iconic and perfect. And sure enough, I mean, those guys almost are the the icon of the Last Jedi so far, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, some characters, in particular, DJ Benicio del Toro's characters, just went through months of development, and then in contrast to that, you'll get a moment where Tonchi just nailed it on first pass.
So take us through the process on this. Is it just that there's a basic idea? Is there a sentence? Is there an image that they send you? Say, oh, we want something along these lines. They just describe the character's role to you. How does it go from where does it start?
It's essentially ideas from Michael, you know, the main costume designer. Mm. And they'll, depending on the sort of level of character, there'll be mood boards. He'll have stacks and stacks of printouts and photocopies of photos and images and pictures from, you know, the last 100 years. Well, mm-hmm. You know, it really spans, you know, a huge amount of influences that he takes from. Mm-hmm.
I remember once I think this was possibly for DJ again, the Benicio character. I think he brought to your desk like two photos, and one of the picture like a 1950s teddy boy. Yeah. And one of the bloke in a suit of armour, like medieval armour. Is it like,
yeah,
I want something like that. Like, okay.
Yeah, it's often quite disparate things, but you know, you've got to, you know, when you have such a blank canvas, you have just got to throw around as many ideas as you can, you know. And like Chris was saying, for DJ, like, we all did many, many, many drawings of that guy. And he went through all kinds of iterations. So, yeah.
There was a kind of X factor about it, wasn't there, at those points?
Yeah, there was, yeah.
well, in that case, was there ever a point where you'd all done a pass on something and they went with one and you were like, ah, oh, yeah, mine's better than that?
No.
there were times when we'd be given a brief and I did think, I've got this one. I'm going to bloody nail this one. I know it because I know what they want. And then I draw it and like, they just come and go, no, that's not what we want at all. And I'm like, ah.
Yeah, but I mean, Mike, but like, you know, joking aside, actually, you know, I think the four of us had just brought different things to the table and kind of, you know, that sort of competitive idea doesn't work at all. You know, we're all working together to make as good a piece as we can.
Mm.
Yeah, you had to leave your ego at the gates of Pinewood. At the end of the day, the finished drawings belong to Star Wars. It's very hard to sort of look at my stuff and go, that's 100% Chris Weston. It's just not possible. I mean, even the most successful costume I had, which was the Canto Bight policeman, even that started out as an old Ralph McQuarrie sketch. You know, it's very hard to feel like 100% ownership of anything that ended up on the screen.
So coming back to the process in its entirety, you're creating these sketches, you have essentially a blank canvas. How much feedback was coming from the very top? Was it mostly from the costume designer, who would then take things on to the director when he was happy, or were there directions coming from the director himself?
We had a what's called a design room, and that would be a square room with the walls filled with our drawings, basically, and stuff was selected for the walls by Michael, the costume designer. And then every few weeks, Ryan would come in and see what we had done and then give feedback there. And then we'd go away and, you know, for another round. And it was that for yeah, like 9 months pretty much. So, but the design room, that's you know, you were always, Michael would always give you feedback as you're working, and then, you know, when Ryan was coming in, we'd print the stuff out nicely, and we'd look through it and see, you know, select various things that would go up on the walls. Mm. And yeah, and then we get feedback from Ryan.
Sometimes it was a manic race to get them all printed out before.
Yeah,
and it did get a bit stressful. I'm not going to see it.
How did this process? I'll come to Jock first on this one. How did the process on this compare to other films that you've worked on?
I'd say that on the other stuff I've done, I've been far more directly involved with either the director or the production designer or the costume designer. This one was actually working with the costume designer, but you know, Star Wars is obviously huge, and as I said earlier, you know, there's hundreds of people in various departments, so it felt a little bit more when you work on a film, you're always, you know, the good thing about comics is that, you know, what people see is your work, and 100%, and of course in a film you're only ever serving the film itself, so it's you're kind of, you know, you're a cog in the mechanics kind of thing, and I'd say on this one I felt that more so, but even so, I don't know how Chris felt with this, but you know, we had complete creative freedom, you know, that we were encouraged to try stuff, you know, try left field stuff, just try, you know, just kind of go for it and try different things, and I've been lucky that in the films that I've worked on, that's always been the case. You know, it's almost like the understanding that, you know, the way to get good work out of creative people is just to sort of, like, you know, wind them up and let them go kind of thing, and that was no different on this film. You know, it was really, so, you know, so when there were you know, for example, there's one costume for me that I didn't even know whether it would make it in the final film, but it was Luke's final costume when he are we allowed spoilers on this, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay, when Luke turns up on Crait near the end, and he's in like a black kind of samurai robe, and they weren't sure whether they wanted a third costume for Luke, and I had an idea for a riff on his Jedi costume, and I just said, you know, can I try something, and I tried it and they liked it, and that's really close to what I came up with. So, you know, so even though it was a huge, you know, monolith of a film, you know, at its heart is still, you know, that kind of sort of you know, creativity, which, you know, like 2000 AD, it's you know, people doing what they love to do and bringing it to the table.
Mm. Now, I think you really knocked it out of the park with that final costume. It was really fantastic.
Cheers, because I've got a bit sitting in the cinema, and I literally didn't even know whether it was in there. And Luke comes on screen, and it was like, you know, it is quite a surreal feeling.
Mm. Chris, what about you? Because you as you partially referenced earlier, you worked on the live action Akira film before it was shut down.
Mm.
What was your position on that film, and how did it compare to working on The Last Jedi?
It was a very different experience. I was sort of pretty much a costume concept artist on that as well, but as well as doing storyboards, and I took a pass on the motorbike as well. So as I say, as ever with the work I've done with Albert Hughes, it's very hard to put one label on what I actually do. Yeah. Film. I'm a jack of all trades, really, on his films. So I flitted between a bit of concept design, a bit of storyboard, a bit of costume design, even just like doing a bit of artwork to show to actors to try and entice them on board. Whereas on The Star Wars Last Jedi, I was purely just working on costumes. And also, all of the work I did on Akira was done from my studio in Eastbourne. I didn't have to travel anywhere. I could carry on living at home. Mm. But The Last Jedi, it was far more sort of an immersive experience. It was like going off to a boot camp in a funny sort of way. when you walk around Pinewood Studios, I've been brought up on army camps because my dad was in the army, and it did feel very familiar to what army bases are like with the barracks and stuff. It felt much more like I was part of a sort of military operation.
When you're a comic book artist, and this is something that quite a few guests on the podcast have mentioned over the years, you're in one room, effectively on your own, for most of the day, drawing away. But this was seems like a much more of a not just a job to which you commute, but also something that the where you have colleagues who are in the room with you, and you're bouncing ideas off. So I think Jock, you used to share a studio with Lee Garbutt, did you?
I did.
Yes. Yeah.
And Dom.
Yeah. And I think McMahon and Gibbons used to share a studio as well. So how did that make it different in terms of your experience, not just being in the room, but also going to work every day?
The first thing is, I'm sharing a studio with Jock and Tonji. I mean, two of the best comic book artist in the business, so instantly I'm thinking, oh my god, I've got to up my game so much to compete with them. But apart from that, I've hung out with Jock at conventions, so it's just sort of like a business as normal, but except without being drunk, really.
I was drunk all the time, the entire process of The Last Jedi.
I'd like work solidly probably for an hour and a half. Then you'd have to get up and stretch your back, and I'd always sort of sneakily walk behind their monitors, have a look over their shoulder, see what they're working on. It always made me think, oh my god, get back to your chair, get drawing again quickly.
It was for me. It was like you say, Mike, because I am literally in a room by myself. Which is, you do choose that as a comic artist. I'm fine with my own company, but it was, and working at Pinewood is it's amazing. I felt very kind of privileged to be doing it, to be honest, because like Chris was saying, working with other amazing people, if everyone's at the top of their game. You're creating something. I grew up loving Star Wars, so there's that element to it as well. I really enjoyed working up at Pinewood, just the whole experience of it.
And how much did you both? How much were you changed by this experience? Because obviously, 9 months of your lives devoted to effectively one thing. How much did it affect the way you think about the way that you do art and the way you now do art?
For me, it was massive, actually, for one very, very simple reason. When I draw comics, I use a lot of black, lots of black, lots of shadow to create drama and tension and everything else. And when I first started doing some pieces, I'd do some an image of a rebel bomber, and Michael would come over and he'd say, well, what's that down there? And that would be like a solid black leg where I was trying to create some weight and drama to the image, and he'd say, well, I can't see what's going on down there. So I personally had to completely rethink how I was going to present my images, but that was a really good thing to do, because the other thing about comics is if you've been doing them a few years and you've had a reasonably successful career, you do have your kind of nuts and bolts and ABCs that you sort of fall back on, that are going to work, and I realized that I couldn't rely on those things with this project, and I had to be. It was almost like when I worked on Dread as well. It was kind of if everything in it had to be there for a reason, and you had to show it as kind of clearly as you can. And it did absolutely make me rethink how I was presenting stuff. But the offshoot is that it made my work clearer and more. Just clearer, because it had to be, you know, for people to understand how to then, you know, put the costume together and actually make the thing that would sit on a person. So personally, I felt like I kind of changed 1,000%, and anything that makes you do that, I think, is a good thing.
Hmm. What about you, Chris?
I feel like, as we said before, we tend to work in solitude in our little studio. It's a bit like being a hermit, and you know, unless you're working on a film, you're basically staring at the same four walls. You're drawing from your own pool of inspiration. I think that just the fact I've gone off and interacted with other artists, and even with, not necessarily artists, maybe even like the heads of department are coming in and bringing me their inspiration. I think it just opened up my mind to whole lots of concepts and inspirations that I'd never encountered before.
Yeah, definitely. Agreed.
And you can get a bit closed off and start just, unless you're careful with this job, you can end up refining the same drawing over and over again. And you can see plenty of artists who do that. Basically, they just need to get out of the studio and get some inspiration from somewhere else. And I think that's what 9 months on Star Wars did for me. It just showed me a whole new load of ideas that I've never encountered before.
Mm. It was one question I did want to ask was about whether on occasion you develop a kind of tunnel vision on a design, whether that's a risk that you run when you're working on the same, effectively the same idea, the same image day in, day out.
That can totally happen, but part of the job is having the initiative to step away from it. And you know, there's always another character that you've got on your table, and it's just having the ability to recognize when it starts, you know, kind of having a black hole effect where it's folding in on itself, as opposed to instead of staying on top of it, you know, you start kind of spiraling, wondering whether you're going in the right route. And I found that the best thing to do was put it aside and just, take a walk, look in the design room, then go back and do something else.
Mm. I mean, even your walks around the studio, it can end up in influencing your artwork. I remember one helmet I designed. The inspiration came from the mudguard on a JCB I saw just parked alongside one of the sound stages. I just saw the mudguard and I thought, ooh, that's a good idea for a helmet.
Brilliant. What I found interesting, because I haven't seen a copy myself, but there's the book of the art of the Last Jedi, which has come out, and I've seen stuff that's popped up online. And I want to loop back to what Jock was saying about making stuff clearer, because I noticed, Jock, that the images that I've seen have been in colour. Now, normally when you do comic stuff that isn't covers, you're working in black and white.
Mm. Yeah.
Did you have to, were you applying lessons about colour that you'd learnt in comic books, or did you, for the sake of this clarity, for, you know, the sake of someone having to look at it and make a costume out of it, did you have to find new ways of colour that focus on light and form and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I found my key was kind of for it to try and make it clear, but also still be kind of... I don't want to say sophisticated, meaning kind of in the wrong way, but still all the range and values that make it feel like it's part of a real world. Mm. But nonetheless, there's got to be a slightly graphic quality because so that it's very clear on the page. But then comics are like that too, really. So it was like Chris said, it was just more. Getting different influences, trying different things, and and putting them down. That's a really rambling answer. I might get you to edit that one out. Yes, I did change, Mike. Yes,
right,
I did.
Okay, right, fair enough, fair enough.
Yeah, get rid of that. That was rubbish.
I was forced to come up with a new style, really, to suit the needs of the job. Developed this technique of doing the costume design in a pencil drawing and then scanning that in and then digitally tinting the pencil drawing or adjusting the colours on it. So basically, I ended up something that looked like it was done in coloured pencils, except it wasn't. It was just done in, you know, a lead pencil and then retinted.
Yeah, because in fact, because having worked on a few films before this, I already approached film work a little bit differently to comics. You know, there's definitely sort of stuff which applies to both. But most of the film work, you have to do painted full color anyway, because it's just the nature of the medium. So the only difference for me was, as I say, just a few weeks in, finding a slightly more clear line, and that was just about having a solid black line around every element of each costume. But still, the color would be maybe then slightly more desaturated or washed out, but rather than the kind of solid black shadows, as I was saying. But it still had hopefully the sort of depth and breadth of something that exists in the real world.
Chris, as referenced earlier, you know, you are one for detail in your drawing, you made the comment about concept design and storyboarding kind of coming together in the stuff you've been doing before. I would have thought that somebody who is very, very focused on detail would have been an absolute boon to a costume designer. Was there ever a time you had to dial that back a little bit, be a bit more free and easy?
What do you think, Joe? Do you think I dialed it back at all?
Chris's drawings were insane. Some of the time, I would just look at them and they'd just be so detailed and so rich and so much going on. I don't think he dialed it back.
Same old show I normally do.
I mean, there were some, you know, particularly when Chris gets hold of little bits of tech, you know. Like, Chris, do you remember you did one when Finn wears his kind of Bacta suit, which is like his healing suit, which had water in it, and Chris, which is in the art book, I think. Chris did this kind of frame around Finn. You know, just sort of, again, using his initiative, it was a brand new drawing. It wasn't necessarily suggested, and he just did this insane piece of equipment. And, I mean, it was incredible, you know, just...
That was an example of me not quite understanding the brief, because... Because they told me that Finn was going to be wearing the Bacta suit, but it was going to be full of liquid. So it crossed my mind going... How the hell, you know, what's this to stop this? A, would he be able to walk in a big suit filled with liquid? Would it be too heavy? And B, what's to stop the suit just splitting open under the weight of the liquid? I mean, I instantly imagined it to be like Michelin Man proportions for some reason. So I designed this huge framework that he would go around him that would support the suit full of liquid. So he'd wheel it around like when you go to hospital, you always see people wheeling their drips around. I was trying to think like that. But I think Rob Rowley nailed that one, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Really lovely costume on that. And I think they realised that they wouldn't be able to construct a suit that would contain the liquid, and they would sort of fake it the suit would be double lined, and there'd be a silicon gel in it that would, take the place of the water.
Well, let's talk about some of the designs of yours that did make it into the film. First off, I find it incredible that you were sat there not knowing what did and didn't get in. I mean, that must have been quite a ride.
It was quite exciting. I think I was sat next to my wife, and every time something of mine appeared on the screen, I would squeeze her hand and eventually be going, okay, Chris.
I mean, for film works like that, though, I think. I mean, really, you know, you do 10 drawings and one of them might have something that hits the mark. Mm. And with Star Wars, you know, our jobs were done when they were sort of just shortly into filming. Mm. So there was always that element of the film constantly evolving and changing. So it was a surprise to see, you know, what made it and what didn't, for sure.
Because one particular item which I know you worked on, because you tweeted a picture of it, was Leia's cloak from Crate, and my wife grabbed my arm when she saw it on the screen, and she went, "I want one of those." So thanks for that. That's going to be an expensive Christmas.
Well, I mean, again, you know, it's. All of the elements are a collaboration, you know. You know, one of my drawings does have that big collar, which you know, there's that amazing shot when you first see her on Crate where it's right over her face. And I must admit, I was sat watching it with Rob, you know, one of the other costume artists, and then when that shot came up on screen, he kind of looked over at me, and you know, it's definitely cool to see some of the, you know, the drawing that you've done, sort of, you know, represented sort of in the actual footage. It's quite a thing. But again, yeah, I mean, we all worked on Leia. You know, Tonchi did a bunch of awesome drawings for that cape. Rob did the stuff when she was in the rebel ships nearer the beginning. You know. And it's funny because I can't remember whether that big collar was something Michael asked me to try, or whether it was in, you know, some of the reference, you know, imagery that was kicking around. It's all so sort of, yeah, fluid, you know, for the you just try so many different things, and it's always a little bit of a lottery what ends up on screen.
Chris, we've already mentioned the caretaker nuns that you worked on. Were there any other bits that you spotted which had come from your work?
I think possibly the most successful costume I designed was the Canto Bight Police. Hmm. And again, a bit like the Red Guard, they were something that didn't go through a long process of development. I think I probably nailed that on my third attempt, the Canto Bight Police. Hmm. I mean, the first time I drew them, it was just total 2000 AD. Because it looked like something out of Strontium Dog. And I mean, when they come to you and go, "Right, we need you to design science fiction policemen," I was like, "Yeah, I've got this." Safe ground here. So my very first attempt, which unfortunately isn't in the book, it was very similar to, do you remember the character Harvey in Strontium Dog?
Yeah.
I think that was possibly an influence, but they didn't like that one. And then after that, they found like an old Ralph McQuarrie sketch. We were thinking something more like this, something a bit more samurai. And I think I did one more. I did a drawing of a samurai costume, and I did it in black. And they weren't too keen on the black colour. And then we tried a burgundy one, and I did one in burgundy and one in sort of powder blue, and they loved the powder blue one, and that was pretty much it. It's, you know, very, very quick development on that. So and I think the final costumes look great, and I came very close to playing one of the Canto Bight police in the film, but unfortunately it didn't come to pass.
That's a shame.
when they finished sculpting the helmet, they brought it in to show me, and I was like, "Oh, let me try it on." And Sam Williams, he was the 3D designer in our room, and he went, "Oh, it really suits you, Chris." And then the Michael Kaplan's assistant says, "It does suit you. I think we could probably get you a part as one of the policemen." And I was like, "Yes, I'm going to be in Star Wars." But alas, it never happened. But I'm still really proud of the police. I think the police are me in spirit. if you can imagine me as a space fascist, I think the Canto Bight Police come pretty close to that.
John, what about you? We've already talked about the Leia costume, but you know, I've seen an image of Rey. There was one design of Rose that was very much the kind of almost plumber-esque overalls that she had on, which seemed to be quite different to how it turned out.
Yeah, I mean, they were based on the ground crew, the Rebel ground crew from or Resistance ground crew, should I say, from Force Awakens. And her final costume was actually I didn't do many revisions. That the drawing wise, you know, concept art wise, what you see in the book was the final concept art for Rose. Mm. She wasn't cast at that point, so I think they had three or four different people who were coming in, and they were trying various costumes on. So I think when she was cast, you know, the way she looked was affected by how she looked, you know, in the costume. There was Rey. One of my favorites is I worked on the Rebel Bombers, which is in that sequence at the beginning. Star Wars fans kind of might be sort of, you know, they apply a meaning to everything, and like the colouring of their flight suit was kind of like this kind of yellowy greeny kind of colour. But they actually started out maroon, but I was working on a drawing and got to one of those points that you were talking about where I just felt like I wasn't going anywhere, and I pressed invert on Photoshop, and the purple became this kind of sickly pucey green kind of color, which immediately looked way cooler and just way more kind of, there was way more life in it. And Michael liked it, and there we have it.
Fantastic. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask you is how much interaction you had with the people who are actually making these things. Because, you know, it's all very well to sort of sit down and come up with this detail or this amazing thing, you know, this collar on a cloak or something like that. How was there any sort of back and forth between you and the people who are actually having to make these things a reality?
Not really. When it got to that stage, it was kind of out of our hands, right. They would make them, and then Michael would tweak and change and lengthen and shorten and everything from that point. Because, you know, that's the thing, Michael, he's incredible with materials and the way they sit on people. So our job was to, yeah, you know, sort of feed that element of it, if that makes sense.
So let's talk about influences, because a name that you've mentioned a few times now is Ralph McQuarrie, who was the original designer on the original trilogy. One of the things that I've seen a lot of people mention in relation to The Last Jedi is just how much it harks back to McQuarrie's vision for the original films. I wanted to find out how much of a personal influence it was on both of you.
We're always building on other people's work, and I think Ralph McQuarrie's work is like the main foundation stone of the visual imagery in Star Wars. So yeah, it was definitely always there. I mean, we were encouraged to look at the art of books of the previous films, possibly the original trilogy more than the prequels. I think that you're always encouraged to refer back to the original concept art. I mean, we even got showed concept art that I'd never seen before, and I don't think have ever been published. You know, there's quite a lot of stuff still there in the Lucasfilm archives that people just haven't seen. I think the Canto Bight Police, sorry to keep returning to that character, but I don't think I'd ever seen quarry drawing that they showed me before.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because there's definitely like there's a Star Wars visual language. It took me a couple of months until I really got a handle on it. But there is like a tangible language with which makes something look more Star Warsy, or like Chris says, or does it push into 2000 AD, for example, or does it push into other science fiction films or other tropes that we all know? Clearly the basis of a lot of that language is Ralph's work, and so it was a constant inspiration. Basically, his stuff is so much a part of the foundation of it all that, yeah. But again, we looked at so much different stuff, from all over. And if it worked and it looked like it belonged in a Star Wars movie, then it was in.
I think the instruction I received was no zips, no buttons on the clothes.
Yeah, no zips. Who knew before I started working at Pinewood? But as soon as someone says to you, there are no zips on any Star Wars costumes, you're like, oh my God, no, yeah. there isn't. Who knew? And it's like, well, apparently they knew, but still.
Yeah. So the Star Wars universe relies on Velcro very heavily.
Thinking about this, how much was Star Wars an influence on you? Because I think, John, when you talked about your work on this film online, you referenced your, I don't know, 15-year-old self or whatever. How much was seeing the original trilogy and everything that's happened since an influence on your art pre-working on The Last Jedi?
Well, I came to Star Wars reasonably, funnily enough, I came to Star Wars at the same time as I came to 2000 AD, which I was a bit older than some other people. I was probably about 13 or 14, something like that.
Yeah.
I started collecting 2000 AD, which was a huge science fiction influence, and I loved the Star Wars movies as well. And actually, when I was about 15, I think, I saved up and bought, there was a big hardback book called ILM, The First 10 Years. And I can remember it was like about 35 quid, and this would have been in the mid-80s, late-80s, whatever, which is quite a lot of money for a 14, 15-year-old to save up. And I was so into effects and various elements of those movies that I used to pore over that book. I mean, I know every single page by heart. I've read it a million times. Every single image I used to study and look at. And one of the elements was, that it felt like it was at a distance from me. That there would be no way that I could ever, I don't live in Los Angeles. I'm not part of the film industry. There's no way that I could ever do something like this, but I would love to do something like this. So that kind of rang in my ears, the first time I went to Pinewood, and now we have the art book with our work in it. And it's just like 2000 AD has had a massive influence on me. This is certainly in there as well. And it's just insane to me that I've had been lucky enough to work on both.
For me, just as much as the films, it was the Ralph McQuarrie portfolios that they released at the same time as each film. Did you ever get them, Jock?
No, I didn't actually. I was all about like the making of books, and in fact, I've still got three. They released some at the time when the films came out. These kind of floppy square books. So that I think we're on our tables, Chris, while we're working there. Yeah. And I've still got them here, and they've all they're all taped up with masking tape and gaffer tape to kind of hold the spines together, because I just used to pour through that stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, as I said, for me, as each film, the original trilogy was released, they brought out like this card slipcase that contained 20 paintings by Ralph McQuarrie, and just staring at them, I probably stared at them for longer than I did watching the films. Really, to be honest, they didn't. I didn't really think of them as paintings. I just thought of them as windows into another universe, because it just completely fired your imagination.
Like 2000 AD. That's that was the thing about that's the perfect come around, because that's exactly what 2000 AD did for me as well. Mm. It's I feel like we're really lucky, like the age we are, that we had access to that stuff when we were at that certain age, because you're right, Chris. It was like, yeah, it was just, it was real, It was tangible. And, Yeah.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, we have come round to the point that I wanted to get to, because this wouldn't be the 2000 AD podcast if we didn't in some way talk about 2000 AD. So I kind of wanted to get an idea of is there anything you can think of? Is there a design, a detail or something like that where it's 2000 AD infecting the Star Wars universe?
Chris's unused Canto policeman.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that.
Well, I mean, let's face it. You know, even like me crossing the road is influenced by 2000 AD somehow. It's just part of my DNA now. It's just, I mean, in 1977, my brain was rewired to see the world in a certain point of view, and it just affects everything I do and who I am, really. So I think it's inevitable that you're going to bring it to whatever job you do now, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I wish there was a specific answer I could give you, Mike, but I can't really, off the top of my head, I can't really think of one beyond, like Chris says, just a very obvious all over, you know, influence. Actually, maybe, you know what, there's one thing actually from working on Dread is silhouettes, the shape of a figure is, and when you're doing costume design, that's very, very important, the way material hangs off a body and creates a certain shape, if it's long or shorter, you know, whatever it is. And in fact, Dread made me think about a person's silhouette, and you know, trying to make Dread as a judge. If you saw him in silhouette compared to another judge, you'd still know it was Dredd somehow, and that's a fairly sort of like left field answer, but trust me, it's true, and it's in there.
And with working on something like Star Wars, and you've mentioned Dredd, Chris has mentioned the Akira live action film. Is it me or are comic book artists increasingly in demand over the last sort of 10, 15 years in the film industry for the skills that they have learnt and honed in comic books?
No, I think it's the other way around.
Oh, really?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think the golden age of using comic strip artists was back before concept art was digital. I think the period before, you know, concept art was created in Photoshop and on Wacom tablets. Before that came in, I think that was our golden period of using comic strip artists. When you think like Mike Ploog working on The Thing, Bernie Wrightson working on The Mist. I mean, that's really the golden age of comic strip artists. With Jim Steranko designing Indiana Jones, I mean, it's the ultimate example of a comic strip creator completely affecting the look of a film. I think now the film, the producers and directors don't look at comics so much, and they look more towards possibly the concept artists of computer games, people who are really good at creating photorealistic technique. And I think the appreciation of like a simple line drawing isn't there as much as it used to be. What do you think, Jock?
Well, actually, I was going to say, funnily enough, one of the things that Michael, the costume designer, he loves line drawings, and he was definitely looking for people that could draw. And I think, like Chris was saying, one of the things, if you are a comic artist, that you have to be able to do is draw, and more concept work is, it can be about, you know, photo bashing and you're painting over existing elements and 3D modeling, and then you're lighting that and then using that to paint over and what have you. So that was the one, Michael does really appreciate good drawing, and you know, it's flattering to think that maybe we brought something in that way, you know, to it.
I mean, for me, it's interesting to think of that being the value of bringing in comic book artists to this kind of thing there is a certain look to video game concept art. You know, I'm sat here in a video game studio, you know, which so often is about impression and mood rather than necessarily actual detail. Whereas when you're creating costumes, as we've already detailed, somebody is going to have to make that thing. So you can't hide things. Yeah. You can't fudge it. You can't smudge it, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true. Again, from sort of back working on Dread, I realized that I think when you draw comics, your images always have context. You know, sometimes concept art can be beautiful to look at, but there's nothing interesting about it somehow. So really, I find that a really odd, thing to be the case. But more and more when I look at concept art, I just sort of, I don't get any response to it, even though it looks beautiful. But and I think, you know, with comics, you're constantly thinking about, okay, so if a figure is in there, you know, where's he been and where's he going next, kind of thing, which is you know, storytelling, and I think that can definitely bring something to concept work.
Yeah, I've been really disappointed by some concept art I've seen on films recently. I won't name them, but yeah, a lot of them are just repeating the same visual tricks over and over again, and I think that the age where you get a complete nutcase like H.R. Giger in to come in with a completely unique vision seem to be long gone now. I'm not saying we need more artists like H.R. Giger. I'm saying we need more artists who aren't just reproducing the same Photoshop filter techniques that everyone else is doing.
On something like The Last Jedi, we've touched on how big this production was. You know, 9 months of your lives, lots of people, almost to the point where you are slightly disconnected from the actual filmmaking, because you're kind of, you know, you're doing one job, one cog in a wider machine. Did you enjoy it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, honestly, you know, you had good days and bad days, yeah. And sometimes if things weren't going well because of the position you were in, that actually added to the imposter syndrome kind of feeling, you know, where you question mm-hmm. whether you're actually able to do it. But the truth is now, you know, I mean, maybe 2 years ago now, actually, since we left. So now all I remember, you know, you tend to shed the kind of, you know, the negative stuff and just remember the good stuff. And there's so much good stuff that you said, you know, has it changed? You know, it has definitely changed my life. There's no two ways about it. And it was fantastic.
It was a bit of an emotional roller coaster. I think first month now, I was just crippled by self-doubt and...
that sounds very unlike you, Chris.
the imposter syndrome, I think it probably took me about a month to 6 weeks to relax into it. I think it wasn't until I started drawing the caretakers and suddenly started getting a bit of positive feedback that I relaxed into it. I'm a very shallow person. I need to be told I'm loved, you know, quite frequently.
We love you, Chris. Oh, we love you, Chris.
steady on.
Possibly 4 to 6 weeks, I was thinking, I'm going to get fired any minute now. So I found that quite stressful. Once I got onto the caretakers and I started, I think it takes them a while to work out your strengths. Hmm. Once they saw my caretaker work, they knew what to do with me more. And so I was sort of gently led away from designing women's costumes and over to the creature department and to draw ugly monster costumes. Once I was there, you know, it became a whole lot easier. Every time we got up to go to Loo, we walked past a soundstage that had the Millennium Falcon on it. And how cool is that?
One thing I did wanted to ask about is... was there something about writing people's names in one of the alien languages on helmets?
The Star Wars language is called Orabesh, and my son's name is on one of the alien helmets in the film, which I think is, you know, that's the pinnacle of my career. You know, forget me. The fact that I've got my boy's name on a helmet in Star Wars, that's way better.
Brilliant. I mean, were there any other kind of in jokes or anything like that you managed to squeeze in? Was there a design that you kind of went, this is clever, and then it didn't quite make it in?
I think the one I was disappointed didn't make it in was the going back to Benicio del Toro, who went through hundreds of versions. One of my drawings, he was wearing a medallion made up out of pieces of the Roger Rabbit bots from the prequel. Oh no! And it was also some of the Roger robots and that robot bounty hunter from Empire Strikes Back. And I was really hoping that would get me. Other in jokes. I mean, that's a Star Wars in joke. I can't think of any extra Star Wars in jokes I put in.
No, that's all good. Was there anything that you designed that you were disappointed didn't make it onto the screen?
Yeah, I think I was really disappointed that we didn't get to see more of the caretakers that I designed. I think we only saw two caretakers in the finished film, but I'd actually designed a whole village of them. We got to see the male of the species as well as the female, and they were like based on fishermen. I think that there's a whole sequence in the film that's, you probably end up on the DVD, where they're having a big banquet and a party, and I got to design the caretakers that were part of the band. One of them was blowing a bagpipe that was made out of some sea creature. So there's tons of stuff there that didn't make it into the finished film, which I'm quite sad to see going missing.
But Joel, I guess you sound fairly happy with everything of yours that made it into the film.
I was so lucky, as I say, that a lot of the principals were, I had a hand in the new rebel bombers, and actually one of the things I really liked was this was the thing where I suddenly hit on a style, as it were, which made me feel like I suddenly knew what I was doing, and that was the rebel ground crew, which you see on Crate, and their various kind of like army smocks and gear. I did a bunch of those, and they're all in there. So yeah, no, I mean there was there's elements that you work on that you sort of think, you know, that your preference might have been that you would like to have seen that, but all in all, I feel pretty lucky.
You've now seen the film, that phase of your lives has moved on, that 9 months has gone. Are you both working on anything for 2000 AD at the moment?
I am. Chris, are you?
Oh yes, of course.
Yeah, I'm doing it's going to be the final time that I visit Dread for the Carl Urban 2012 iteration. I'm doing two covers for the new Dread story that's currently running in the magazine, I think, Mike, is that right?
It's just started.
And they're being reprinted for the States, I believe, and I'm doing two covers for that, so it's literally going to be the last time that I draw that guy. So
how do you feel about that, because it's been what, 6 years since it came out?
Yeah, really good. I mean, I'm just looking forward to drawing him, actually, and trying to, you know, do it justice.
Chris, tell us a bit of, you know, what you're working on for 2008 at the moment.
All right, just finished another Dread two-parter featuring Judge Pym, who is the new villain that Robin Williams and I come up with, which I'm quite excited about.
Yeah, he mentioned it on he was on the show a few weeks ago. He mentioned that you were both working on that, because Judge Pym's been quite a popular creation.
Oh, great! Yeah, I think we've got something really cool going on with her. I think she's kind of fills the gap that PJ maybe used to have, perhaps, you know, about a villain who isn't overtly, you know, physical. He's more sort of manipulative and can just run intellectual circles around Dread. It's always great. I mean, there's very few people who in Magazine One who can beat Judge Dredd in a fight, but so it's fun to put someone up against Dredd who can just beat him hands down, but on a different playing field completely.
Brilliant.
And he's not entirely sure if she's good or bad yet, which I quite like. The reader knows that she's a psychopathic serial killer, but Dredd hasn't figured it out yet. Mm. I think the next strip we're doing is quite a sort of it's more like a chess game where she's basically outmaneuvering him politically within the Justice Department. So yeah, look forward to that.
Ah, thoroughly enjoyed that. Hope you did too. Earthlets, thank you so much to Jock and to Chris for spending so much time telling us about the process and taking us behind the scenes on The Last Jedi, one of my favourite films of the year, to no take it backsies. As you will have heard at the beginning of this episode, we are giving away a year's subscription to 2000 AD. How can you win this Czar Jazz Prize? Well, it's quite simple, Earthlets. You'll just have to have listened to this episode in full, because if you want to win a year's subscription to 2000 AD, you just need to answer this very simple question. What item of clothing did Chris Weston design for the Cantabite police in Star Wars The Last Jedi? What was the item of clothing he designed for the police in Canto Bite? To enter, jot down your answer plus your postal address and name in an email and send it to Thrillcast, that's all one word, at 2000adonline.com. Thrillcast, Thrillcast, at 2000adonline.com. There are some stipulations about who can and can't enter. If you are a resident of Pluto or the asteroid belt, then unfortunately we're unable to send your prize out to you. But as for the rest of you, may the best Earthlet or non-invasive species win. Well, hope you've enjoyed our third birthday episode, Earthlets. And thanks again to Jock and Chris for being absolutely fantastic guests. Thank you to you, our listeners, for just tuning in every 2 weeks. Don't forget to leave some feedback on iTunes or the podcast app of your choice, or even just let us know on the Thrillcast email if there are guests or features that you'd like us to run in the future. Here's to another 12 months of the galaxy's greatest podcast. Splendid Verth Frigg, Earthlets.
Alert! 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 Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000adonline. And follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.